what I would say the star of Austrian economics and certainly the star of the Mises Institute. Dr. Murray Rothbard got his PhD at Columbia University. He studied for more than 10 years under Ludwig von Mises at NYU. He's now S.J. Hall Professor, Distinguished Professor of Economics at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Academic Vice President of the Mises Institute, editor of our journal, and I would say, both in ideological and in personal terms, keeps us all on the straight and narrow, and the heart and soul of the Institute, which to me is only appropriate since obviously the greatest Misesian. He's today going to talk to us about desocialization in theory and practice, Dr. Rothbard.
Thank you. It's really a great occasion in many ways. The one is the fact that the communist revolution took place last year, and secondly, topped off by this conference, which I think is a very moving experience, particularly the last session where Lithuanian and Russian collaborating on the sort of so the whole thing is like a free market international, you should excuse the expression. It's really tremendous. It's the real international, the whole people getting together and uniting behind the free market. I thought I'd start off before getting to a program of desocialization to talk about the what used to be the famous, I guess it's come back, is the famous socialist calculation debate. When I went to Columbia in the 1940s, an undergraduate and graduate school, they were talking about the socialist calculation debate. And it was sort of done in nostalgic terms at that point because it was a debate that was previously famous but had now been, was now over, concluded, finished. And the reason why it was concluded is because socialism had won out, it triumphed. And I remember listening to a lecture, I was lucky enough to listen to a lecture by one of the most eminent Soviet economologists, if you use the term, Soviet economic expert, Abram Bergson, who sort of set down the official orthodox line on the socialist calculation debate, which he, I think around the same time, wrote in an official volume of the American Economic Association on current thought. And I think later years, Bergson partially retracted this position. Anyway, the orthodox line went as follows. Mises had done socialism the great service of raising the problem of socialist calculation. And fortunately, it was now solved with a great, you know, obvious sigh of relief by all the economic experts. And a solution proffered by the Polish exile Oskar Lange and also Abba Lerner 2 years earlier, this is Oskar Lange in 1936. And the dominant orthodoxy at this point, this is the 1940s, was saying, well, fortunately, you know, at least the socialism has no problem anymore because fortunately we have solved the question. There's no more problem with that Soviet economic calculation. And to understand the importance of this debate, I want to go back to the other big problem, which everybody has recognized, both socialists and non-socialists, since socialism came up as a question. The other economic problem, aside from calculation, was everybody has long realized, since socialism was first advanced in the 18th century or even earlier, is that socialism suffers from the incentive problem. This is pretty clear. If, for example, everyone under socialism either receives an equal income or in the alternative variant, everyone is supposed to produce according to his ability, unquote, and receive income according to his needs, then to sum it up in what used to be a famous question, who under socialism will take out the garbage? This was this is the way it was usually phrased. In other words, what will be the incentive to do the grubby jobs and to do them well, and first to do them and actually to do them successfully? Or to put it another way, what would be the incentive to work hard and be productive at any job, garbage or anything else? So that was the question. It was pretty clear to everybody this was a real problem. The traditional socialist answer to this was that socialist society would in some way transform human nature, that it would work on human nature to eliminate evil selfishness so that everybody would be eager and ready and willing to leap to attention and obey the orders of the socialist state. So everybody be just, you know, leap, and this is their only objective in life, to follow the socialist orders. Now, throughout the history of socialism, a very bloody history of 20th century socialism, the socialist ultras, or consistent militants, whatever you want to call them, such as Mao Zedong and Che Guevara, have wanted to replace the so-called material incentives by so-called moral incentives, so that you have equal income and or according to your needs, and replace this by moral incentives, recognition by society that he's doing a good job. This was properly and wittily ridiculed by the British economist Alexander Gray, who wrote a marvelous book called The Socialist Tradition, came out in the 40s. And he called this the idea that the world may find its driving force in a birthday honors list, giving to the kingdom necessary 365 birthdays a year. So that this would replace these ribbons and medals and the Order of the Bath, etc., would replace material incentives. Well, obviously, this didn't work. And the success of the socialists in creating the robotic new socialist man was pretty well being demonstrated right now in the rubble of the socialist world. First they started, they thought they could use voluntary persuasion, but very quickly, as trying to transform human nature, they discovered they have to use the mass terror, systematic terror, to try to achieve this new socialism. And of course, they were not successful. I must say also that my old friend John Gray, is an Oxford political theorist, wrote an article a couple of years ago. I forget now which journal it was in, but anyway, wrote an article saying, well, it's all finished. The communists have managed to create a new socialist man, and therefore everything is hopeless from now on. They're just slaves, and that's it. Fortunately, that was proven to be immediately untrue. So I think that, and it's certainly a testament to the spirit of freedom that cannot be quenched in the human breast, that socialists fail, even despite systematic terror, despite brainwashing and all the rest of it, and to achieve anything like their goal, that freedom just pops up in response. I remember one time many years ago, this is the 1950s, I met Gordon Tullock, who's now chief fame and fortune, or at least fame, and is one of the founders of the public choice movement. And he and I were both working for an obscure organization which quickly collapsed. But at any rate, I had just seen a Yugoslav film on China. It was a very chilling film because I remember the interviewer asked this Chinese couple, you have these kids and then what is your objective? What would you like these kids to achieve when they grow up? And they answered, all we want is for the kid to obey the orders of a socialist state. I figured, Jesus, is this really true? Are they really creating a new robotic human being? So I asked Gordon that. Gordon was a Chinese expert. This is not largely known out of the economics profession, but he was in the State Department in Korea, in the Korean War, and China, in the Korean War, and he was interned by the Chinese communists. So he managed to amass a certain capital in prison. It was terminal leave pay, so to speak, from prison. At any rate, he was a China expert, and I asked him, was this really true? And he said, look, don't worry about it. It's an ancient Chinese tradition. You tell the central government official comes around to your village, you tell them what they want to hear, and as soon as they leave, you forget about it. So he proved, of course, to be right. So even Chinese tactics did not succeed in creating the new socialist man. But anyway, the Mises' challenge, in his famous article in 1920 on socialism, was totally different. He wasn't talking about the incentive problem. Essentially, what he said, look, say for the sake of argument, that they do create a new socialist man. Somehow, man is transformed. All he wants to do is to obey the orders of the state. What will the state be able to tell him what to do? He's willing to obey orders, okay. His incentives are great. What will the socialist planners tell him? What can they tell him about what should be produced, where to produce it, what techniques to use, what raw materials to use, what processes, where in the structure of production should they do it? And his point was they have no way to do it. The socialist planners have no criterion to fulfill even their own goals, much less the goals of consumers, because they have no means of calculation. That was the socialist calculation problem. And he was certainly one of the first to advance it, in a challenging fashion. Interestingly enough, the socialists, I think, in those days were more honest than they became later, because they really worried about it. It was a tremendous debate, mostly in Europe, between socialists and anti-socialists, and trying to figure out the way to solve the Mises problem, how to calculate. essentially what he said was that if the economy is any larger than a Robinson Crusoe level or family level, the socialist planner will not know what to do. They will not know what techniques to use, what process to produce, etc. And because they lack the indispensable tool which private entrepreneurs can use to calculate on the market, namely the existence of a market and the means of production. A genuine market based on profit-seeking entrepreneurs and private owners of those means of production. So, and since he believed that therefore there was no possibility of calculating, he concluded that the planning board would not be able to plan, would not be able to make any rational economic decisions, that their decisions would be arbitrary and chaotic, and that therefore the existence of a socialist planned economy is, as he called it, literally impossible, a word which really was a jab on the gut to every socialist. So it was also a term ridiculed by Mises' critics, as we'll see in a minute. So, as I say, the socialist economists wrestling with the problem were much more honest, I think, than they were later. They were worried about it, and they finally threw in the towel on the standard socialist answer. In other words, the standard socialist program had been for decades or centuries that it's no problem. What happens is the workers will contribute according to their ability. They will produce and put their product on the social heap, the social parking lot, so to speak, and people will take according to their needs from this heap, this vast agglomeration. And there's no need for money, there's no need for pricing or costing or anything of that sort. Well, the socialists gave up under the hammer and blows of the Misesian challenge. They gave up that argument. That program is obviously impossible. They gave up the Marxian variant of having tickets issued on labor hours according to your labor input. That was thrown out by alleged Marxists. And so they wind up in the Longa Lerner so-called solution in the 1930s. They say, yeah, well, okay, it's true these things won't work. It's true Mises was right about that. You can't have a social heap and without money and prices. And you can't have labor tickets, labor hours, currency of any sort. And essentially what they said, we socialists will replicate the market. We'll have a market too. We'll have a better market because there'll be perfect competition and it'll be pricing according to marginal pricing and all the rest of it. And we could just replicate a better market. And that was the so-called market socialist solution. The planning board could fix accounting prices. And longer we go into modeling, you say, look, there's no problem. Look at what the retail store does, for example, right now. A retailer is trying to fix the price of his products. If he fixes the price too high, there's unsold products on the shelf. If he fixes it too low, there's a shortage. And so he adjusts the price to clear the market. Well, the socialist planner can do the same thing. They'll just clear the market too. No problem. And as I say, everybody heaved a sigh of relief that socialism indeed was economic. And most economists, even non-socialist economists, agreed to this. Schumpeter, for example, was certainly not a socialist economist, but under the sway of the Walrasian general equilibrium model, which of course Longa and Lerner are also adopting here, sure, of course the market, they have this consumer goods, and the consumer goods are determined by consumers voting their dollars for marks or whatever freely. And then, as Schumpeter put it, his famous phrase, the prices are imputed to the cost of the factors of production, period. Imputed. Hayek had a very good critique of that. How is this imputation supposed to take place? What mystical process of imputation without a market? And that, of course, is the problem. The planning board has no way of doing it. So, but in the course of this, I recommend, by the way, going back and reading the Mises Institute is the process of reprinting Mises' original article of 1920, because the interesting thing is all these critiques, the Longa Lerner so-called solution, etc., were already discussed and refuted by Mises in advance. And so it's interesting to read Mises attacking these people before they wrote the material, and they seem to ignore the fact that Mises had done that. Anyway, the Longa Lerner solution, all the celebrations of it, which took place in the late 30s and 40s, ignored several very important points. One is they ignore the fact that Mises had already conceded the fact, you can have a market of consumer goods. That's not the problem. The problem is that once you get past consumer goods, you have a whole structure of capital, structure of production, a time structure, and there's no way, since there's no market, there's no private ownership of the means of production, there's no way for the planners to figure out what to do, where to put their, how to impute, quote-unquote, prices back to the factors of production. So all that was ignored. The idea that the Mises was concentrating on the capital goods, which is precisely the problem, was totally evaded or ignored by the critics, by the socialists, and as I say, non-socialists. In his final refutation of the longer learner solution in Human Action in 1949, Mises also, I think, very properly ridiculed the idea of the state ordering managers to cope what he called play market. As if you have a monopoly game or something. So to tell the manager, okay, go out and pretend that you're entrepreneurs and figure out prices and costs, etc. And he pointed out only private ownership, only when the businessman or whatever really the owners of the resources, they're committing their own resources to the at risk, so to speak. Only then can they really have a market. Otherwise, they're just playing games. It's essentially an accounting fiction. And accounting fictions don't work. There's no risk involved in accounting fiction, so to speak. Another point was that another interesting point here about, in addition to Schumpeter claiming that there's no problem about socialist calculation, Frank Knight, the head of the revered founder of the Chicago School, took the same position. He said there's no problem either. He had a review of Mises' socialism when it was translated into English, and plus other reviews of socialist books in the mid-30s in the Journal of Political Economy. He said almost the same thing. He said there's no economic problem under socialism. There's no difference, said Knight, between a capitalist economy and a socialist economy. They both have managers. They both have consumers. They both have workers. What's the problem? The only problem, said Knight, is under socialism is political. In other words, there might be some problems of tyranny and things like that. But economically, there's no problem. And it's interesting to understand that Professor Molsap has a file of, which I'm anxious to see someday, of statements by eminent economists in the past saying that there's no problem about socialist production, and everything would be great, and just as good as capitalist. And one interesting thing about Knight is the way he talks about this discussion of the socialist problem, socialism, it seems to me he was misled by his capitalist theory. It's an interesting point here about how seemingly recondite points of theory have vital political impact. Knight was the Austrians pioneered, as a matter of fact, still the only group who recognize the fact that capital is a time structure. It's not just a homogeneous blob. It's a structure. It's a lattice work going up through time. So you have the so-called higher orders of production, which are the remote, such as machine tools and raw materials and whatever, and it goes down in stages through capital goods structure into the consumer goods. And all of these things have to be integrated. It can only be integrated by a market economy with private ownership. Well, Knight, along with Keynes, by the way, in modern Anglo-Saxon economic theory, believes that capital is just a homogeneous lump, a blob. And if it's really a blob, there probably is no problem of economic calculation. If you just add capital and somehow magically the products come out, crank out the machine, indeed there is no problem. And I think, and this is very interesting because it goes back, as I say, to recondite capital theory. Knight was a fanatical opponent of Austrian time theory of capital. And unfortunately, he won out in the not in truth, I think, but in the Gallup polls of economics, of economists, so to speak. So that ignoring the fact that says this whole structure, which has to be maintained, has to be integrated and meshed together, can only be done by a free market. Another problem was that Mises was ill-served by his defenders. Here I want to get to the orthodox line of the history of the calculation debate, which was propounded by Bergson and others, almost everybody else in the 40s. The orthodox line was as follows. Mises opened up the debate in 1920 that claiming socialism is theoretically impossible, can't calculate. And then Baroni, Enrico Baroni, a Pareto school person in Italy, showed that there's enough equations to solve the theoretical problem. It's a simultaneous equation, they all fit together. That takes care of Mises. And then Hayek and Robbins retreated to a second line of defense as disciples of Mises and said, look, it's true that socialism can theoretically calculate, but in practice it'd be difficult. There's practical problems of getting the equations lined up or whatever. And then of course Longa and Lerner claimed they had solved this practical problem. Well, first there are a lot of things wrong with this. In the first place, Mises didn't care about the equations. To him, theory didn't mean a series of equations. It meant the theory of what could actually happen. It's a real-world theory, so to speak. Second of all, it was sort of overlooked that Baroni's refutation took place 12 years, was written 12 years before Mises' article. And Mises was very familiar with it, didn't think it was relevant. Indeed, it wasn't to the whole problem. Only if you think mathematics supersedes reality do you think this is an important point. Hayek and Ramos did not retreat. This was a phony position coined by Lange and the other supporters. They did deviate. What they did was very subtly and probably unwittingly shift the whole emphasis of Mises had, and they unfortunately weakened it. What Hayek stressed was two points as the essence of the debate, both of which are important and correct, but which are irrelevant to Mises' point. They're just other glosses on the whole problem. One point he said was that in a world, essentially saying, well, if a world was static, maybe socialism could calculate. But since the world is dynamic and changing and innovating, the socialist market can't keep up with the innovations. They can't absorb it. Okay, so you can't. So that would fail in that sense, the planning board. And secondly, he said that Hayek pointed out that the socialist planning board doesn't know the facts. It doesn't know what's going on. It doesn't know everybody's value scales. It doesn't know the techniques. It doesn't know resources. And so they start not as omniscient, but as knowing practically nothing and just getting stuff fed to them by statistics and managers and so forth. They know much less than the market, because the market disseminates knowledge through the price signals and cost signals in the market. And so each entrepreneur, each person in the market knows different things, and they sort of share information through the market. Now, these are interesting points, and I think they're valid, but they're irrelevant, because that was not Mises' point. Mises' point was, and unfortunately Mises' point gets lost in the debate because both the followers and the critics ignore the point, tends to get lost. Mises' point was very different. He said, granting that the system is not changing, granting that the planning board knows everything in advance, not that they really do, but just granting for sake of discussion, granting all that, granting they don't care about the consumers, granting all the planners want is their own values imposed on the system, granting all that, they still can't calculate. That's the interesting point. It's a totally different point. They still can't do it, even if you grant all these impossible points, because they haven't got a market, they haven't got real exchange, real money, and the means of production. So they can't even calculate their own ends. Presumably they want some production of their own goals, achievement of their own goals through production. An interesting thing, one of the reasons why his followers neglected this is a point which I picked up on when I was working on my booklet on Mises, and in his memoirs he talks about how he came to the socialist calculation debate. He did not come to it, as I previously thought, by simply looking around and seeing the socialism had triumphed in Europe and trying looking at the problem. His discussion of socialism grew out of his book, The Theory of Money and Credit, which he published just before World War I. And the way it grew out of it was that he showed in his theory is the first and last, I would say, theory which integrated theory of money with micro theory of prices. And not only is he the first one to do it, it hasn't been absorbed yet into economic thought. I mean, economists are still looking for a way to integrate micro and macro, ignoring the fact that Mises already did it in 1912. So Mises, starting with individual human action and micro action, so to speak, builds up his monetary theory and integrates it with prices. And in doing that, he realized several things. He realized that values are subjective and ordinal, can't be measured. And therefore, since they're subjective and ordinal, they cannot be directly transformed into cardinal numbers. In other words, money prices and money costs. Impute values, as Schumpeter would put it, from consumer goods to capital goods to factors of production. Market can only act through the medium of money. In other words, real money really owned by people. And so this is one of the key points. It's not, in other words, you can't use accounting fictions on some planning board's desk drawer to find out what prices are and what costs are. You have to have money, which is really money growing up on the market as a real commodity, usually gold or something redeemable into gold, and which then set where people exchange ownership into gold and out of gold, etc., which really establishes real prices, which can then be used for calculating, estimating what costs and prices are and hopefully will be or expected to be. And so the mathematical equations and accounting fiction, all the rest of it, are totally irrelevant, totally beside the point, and misconstrue the whole problem. So Mises arrived at his theory of socialism through his theory of money. And since his theory of money wasn't understood by hardly anybody, it was no wonder that his theory of socialism wasn't understood either. And Robbins, Lionel Robbins, also added his own brand of unfortunate obfuscation of the issue. His discussion of socialism, he said that, the problem with socialism was that the planners won't be able to count the equations, the way he put it. The need of the plan, the economy, have all these simultaneous equations. They haven't got the knowledge, they won't be able to do it. So he really was the one of the three people, he's the one who really put it on the so-called practical basis of the equation problem. Well, the interesting thing is, after this was, and it's, of course, it's a typical Valrasian point. In other words, all there is in the economy is a bunch of mythical auctioneers counting, enumerating things and trying to count equations. And this is all that you need to be done. Interestingly enough, even though Longa had supposedly triumphed, and he said he triumphed, and everybody else said he triumphed, the whole thing seemed to be worrying him, because what happened was he was teaching at the University of Chicago during the war. As soon as the Polish communist government was established, he rushed to Poland to participate in the rule and leadership of the communist regime. He became ambassador to the United Nations. He became ambassador to the United States, then ambassador to the United Nations from Poland. He became chairman of the Polish Economic Council, all these high posts. Interestingly enough, in the entire time that Longa was alive, until 1965, I think, and since then, the Polish communist government never tried to institute his so-called market socialism, never. Neither has anybody else. No communist regime has ever implemented a so-called solution. Interesting question. The things seem to be nagging at Longa, because the last publication before his death, or one of the last, he hailed the advent of a new, great new thing which finally really solved the problem. Computer. Computer is going to do it, he says. This is an article called Computer in the Market. And he writes this, as I think, in 1965, just before he died. He says, now we have the final solution. He says, quote, this is where he's reminiscing about the calculation debate. Were I to rewrite my essay today, my task would be much simpler. My answer to Hayek and Robbins would be, so what's the trouble? Let us put the simultaneous equations on an electronic computer, and we shall obtain a solution in less than a second. The market process with its cumbersome tatonement, means cumbersome Malraysian auctioneer, appears old-fashioned. Indeed, it, the market, may be considered as a computing device of the pre-electronic age. That's it. Computers solve the whole problem. And I remember socialists were saying that after that. Well, that's it. That's the computers had it. Well, I don't know. I know very, very little about computers. In fact, next to nothing, probably less than anybody in the room. But my computer friends assure me this is the reverse of the truth. Professor Maltsev wrote an article in the Freeman saying that his friends in the economics planning board in Russia said that, well, a computer could probably solve the problem. It would take 30,000 years to do it. By that time, of course, some data will have changed. Anyway, the practical answer of the socialists at the time was not so much the computer of theory, but simply saying, look, the socialist Soviet government exists, it's doing very well. Our economists tell us that there was Samuelson's famous position that the line's going to cross in X number of years. At some point, the Soviet GNP will be greater than the United States. They're flourishing. Look at the GNP figures of Russia. And therefore, in practice, Mises has been refuted. I mean, how can you say an economy is theoretically impossible and it exists, it flourishes, doing great? Well, now we have a new attitude to it, a revised attitude to that. One of the things Bergson and others said, well, look, the GNP, Russian GNP figures must be correct, because after all, they wouldn't lie just to fool Americans. And of course, Professor Maltsev points out, they lie to themselves. I mean, the managers are claiming there's a lot being produced here, and there ain't nothing going on. one obvious problem with GNP statistics. Another problem about the existence of socialism, such as it was, first of all, there's a lot of black markets, as we all know, and Russia and other communist countries permeated with black markets. The only way the production could go on at all. And I understand in Russia, for example, the manager can't meet the quota, and there are teams of illegal entrepreneurs going around before Gorbachev and saying, look, you can't meet the quota. I have a team of 20 illegal people, and they'll be working hard in 2 months, and you take the money out of the till and pay them. This whole system, I think, is called blot in Russian. But the only way that anything could happen, any production could happen at all, of course, it's an inefficient system, it's better than no system at all. And Michael Polanyi has written some interesting work about how the, even in the so-called planned economy, a lot of unplanned activity takes place in the interstices of the system, where the managers don't have the control and things are going on quasi-illegally. But the major argument, of course, which is what Mises pointed out in Human Action, is that true socialism, full socialism, never existed in these countries because there was a world market, a world capitalist market, so to speak, which set prices to which the socialist countries could refer. A terrible way to do it, but at least they could do it, especially for goods in international trade. They could set steel prices on the basis of the world steel market. They're operating, in other words, as a giant island within a world market. So it wasn't total socialism. At the time that Oscar Lange was helping to plan Polish socialism, the British economist Peter Wiles visited Poland. This was during the mid-1950s. And he asked the Polish economist, how do they plan the system? And he reported, quote, what actually happens is the world prices, i.e., that is, capitalist world prices, are used in all intra-Soviet bloc trade. They are translated into rubles and entered into bilateral clearing accounts. And then he asked the Polish economist the crucial question, well, look, you guys are in favor of world communism. You want to wipe out the capitalist market. What will you do then when you've achieved world communist government? How will you get your prices? They said, and what would you do is say, if there were no capitalist world from which you could obtain all these prices? The Polish planners, rather cynical answer was, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Obviously, they didn't expect or hope to come to it. Fortunately for the world and for themselves, they were never forced to cross that bridge. Well, it's been pretty clear for a long time now, of course, that socialism, even within this world market, hasn't worked. It's been a failure. It's been a flopperoo. That the GNP figures were lies. That although I think this is Professor Maltzow indicated, the CIA is probably the last to realize that. And about 20 years ago or so, I remember there was a joke. Sort of Eastern European type joke in world economic circles. When there were international congresses of economists, the Soviet and East European economists were talking about the virtues of freedom, and the Western economists were talking about the glories of planning. They didn't have to, of course, live under it. And it is not much of a joke that the only Marxists left in the world now are in Western academia, which is nicely insulated, protected from the glories of Marxism. So at this point, we now have one of the interesting questions, why has Eastern European planning and Soviet planning failed even more now than, say, 10, 15 years ago? It's an interesting question which hasn't been addressed too much. I think one, of course, is relative. In other words, Western technology and progress has not been reflected in Soviet Russia or Eastern Europe. And by the way, talking about the glories of the computer, I remember reading the paper in Los Angeles Times, I think about a year ago, that some Western opened up the first fax copying machine center in Moscow. It was a great thing and so forth. And of course, the first was only acceptable in hard money, so the Russians couldn't use it. But he was hoping to set up a chain of copying machines. I mean, you realize you can't have a copying machine in a totalitarian country because they can't allow you to copy anything. And that in itself cuts against socialist planning, much less a computer, or much less a fax machine or whatever. So part of it, as I say, is a relative falling behind the modern Western technology. Second of all, is this cumulative problem of distortions. The more you malinvest, the more you tend to keep malinvesting. And third, I think, which Professor Maltzow alluded to, what's happened in the last 10 years or so is the only good thing I can think of about Marxism is there were hard money types. They weren't in favor of deficit spending or inflation. But now we've added, now the Russians and Eastern Europeans have added Keynesianism to Marxism. That's a really lethal combination. See, you have the usual Marxist planning plus inflationary distortions and all the rest of it. So that really brought all these countries to their knees. although bailout, as I think Professor Maltzow said temporarily by Professor Ostrzeszewski said bailout temporarily by Western banking loans. Riding along for a little while on that. So then the question is which is now being faced by almost everybody, I think, in Eastern Europe and Soviet Union, how to privatize? They almost all agree on a free market. Okay, free market is great. How do we get to it? And it's kind of pathetic. It seems to me that after 50 years of, or 40 years, let's say, of of millions of dollars of grants to scholars in the United States and about communist studies and Soviet studies and all the rest of it, usually talking about through weights and geopolitical game theory. Not one, as far as I know, not one talked about how do you desocialize. I used to dream about this, sort of fantasize about, supposing a Russian leader, Khrushchev or Brezhnev or whatever, would come to the Western leader and whoever and say, okay, I surrender, I've read Human Action, I've read Friedman or whatever, I quit. What do you do next? Tell us what, here are the keys, okay? Here are the keys to the Soviet Union. Do something, desocialize. What would they do? They never thought, nobody's ever thought about this. The American Economic Association, after not thinking about this for 50 years, Atlanta last Christmas, there was sessions on this. This was the big theme, this is a hot topic. But nobody has done any thinking on it. And you might ask Professor Moltsov later to, or in private, whoever has comments on the Western economic attitude. They've got no clue what to do. I think basically is it. So, and I remember watching one of the demonstrations on television. I forget now whether it's Prague or Budapest, but and the people were talking into American TV, and they said, "Look, we've had plenty of advice on how to develop socialism, how to plan, but nobody's advised us how to desocialize. What do we do? Why don't any Westerners help us on this? It's a cry from the heart, and it should be filled, should be satisfied." Another comment was that there are many books telling us how to seize power, and Western thinkers, there are no books telling us how to give up power. Okay. So, it's great that it's come to that point, of course, I'm not belittling this. So then the question is how to privatize, as I think should be done as fast and as comprehensively as possible. We are now at, I don't usually quote Walter Lippmann, I'm not one of his great favorites, but he referred to a situations like this as a plastic juncture in history. In other words, a situation, a revolutionary moment where things are happening very fast. You can do things. Countries are not fixed in an iron mold. Here we have a plastic juncture and things are happening fantastic speed. What do we have to offer? So I'm just, I think it needs discussion, obviously. It's not getting much. So I think, one, obviously, there should be a free price system. Okay, I think it's no question about that. The black market should be legalized, so-called black market, which is simply the real market trying desperately to get out, crying out to get out. And there should be, a key thing, which has of course been mentioned by most people here, is that there has to be private ownership of the means of production. That's the key, because you can't have a fictional free market among state firms. State firms are monopolies, they're state, they don't have to worry about making money and not losing money. They get the money from taxes, they get the money from coerced monopolies. You can't rely on them to act like free entrepreneurs. You can't advise them to play market, as Mises said, against the longer plan, against most of these other plans, too. So then the question is how to privatize. Okay, and that, I think that's the key point. And even though there's a lot of discussion of privatization, the trouble with most discussion of privatization among my friends here in the West is, you know, how to contract out municipal garbage disposal. And I don't want to belittle that, but the point is, how do you privatize the whole country? It's more important, and less has been done on that. And one thing is, of course, which the Hungarian Independent Smallholders Party is stressing, to the scorn of the other free market parties, oddly enough, is to give the property titles back to the people whose property was confiscated after the revolution. And just pure, simple justice, people's lands were confiscated, give it back to them. And of course, it's more difficult in Russia, where the confiscation took place in 1917 and not in 1945. It's easier in Eastern European countries where it's much more recent. But even there, there are title land holdings and title holdings, you can do that. That's the sort of simplest, at least in concept. Second thing is, of course, the old Marxist slogan, which comes back here, which I think Professor Hoppe referred to, land of the peasants, factories of the workers. And it seems to be easy. They have homesteaded this stuff. If they haven't got the title to it, they at least have been using it. They've been establishing a homestead claim, and that would just pure private ownership. Period. And one of the problems here is that there's already a sort of a slight conflict here, people today about should the state sell the factories of the land of the peasants or workers, or should they give it to them? And there's an unfortunate bias, even among free market economists, that's somehow a subsidy to give the people resources. You should really sell it to them. Now, there's several problems with this. One is, do the people have the money to buy it? That's the least important problem. It is a problem. to what is the state going to do with all this money? They're going to sell all these assets. What are they going to do with it? Well, you trust all this money to the damn government? And three is, they don't, do they deserve it? Why, here's a bunch of criminals and robbers. Why do they, even their heirs, they don't deserve this money. They should give it back to the public. It means give it back to the people who either they stole it from or else who've homesteaded it. And so it seems to me they're the last one. The state is the last one who should get the money. And even though you can say, well, it's certain inefficiencies or problems of who gets homesteaded what, it's still better than the government getting it. Then of course another the syndicalist problem, as Professor Hoppe pointed out, comes right in here. Do these people vote? Are they going to grab control? Are they going to have a sort of very inefficient and unjust, as far as I'm concerned, but certainly inefficient producers, co-ops running things? And Yugoslavia tried that to unfortunate results. No, the obvious thing is you give to these people, these workers or whatever, shares of ownership in the capital, individual shares of ownership, which are negotiable on the market. That's a key. You don't say this is your share, but you can't sell it. So that I think is a very important point. Give them shares, and then a stock exchange will then be established, period. I remember one time I was sitting in Mises' seminar, and I asked them, we were talking about the spectrum of socialism, from extreme socialism to free market, etc. I asked them at one point, Professor Mises, is there some criterion you can offer when a country is socialist and when it isn't? I mean, is there some kind of point where you can say this country is no longer, might be statist or interventionist, but it's not really socialist? And is there some kind of criterion you can offer? And he said, yes, the existence of a stock market. If you have a stock market, it means you have shares, negotiable shares, and private titles to ownership, the means of production. I think that's an extremely important point. Most of these communist countries are trying to get stock markets. I think there's sort of embryonic stock markets in most of the countries, but they're not fully developed yet. They're restricted and so forth and so on. But I think it's a very important point. If you have a flourishing, if we look forward, I hope quickly, to the days of a Warsaw and Budapest and whatever stock exchange, we'll be in good, great shape. And not just selling government bonds, by the way. I mean, private owners, private titles, the means of production. So I think that's an important criterion too. One interesting practical problem here is Paul Craig Roberts referred to it when he went to Moscow, because a lot of visiting experts going to Moscow to advise Soviet economists on how to desocialize, and his point was, he made the same point. He said, all land to the peasants, all factories to the workers. And then he raised the question, well, what do you do with the nomenklatura? What do you do with these people? What do you do with the ruling elite? What do you do with the secret police, the beloved leaders? The way he posed it was, you can either cut them in and give them part of the shares, or else you can cut their throats, which would lead to civil war, which might be more emotionally satisfying, but which would lead to civil war and so forth and so on. I think it's a very important point. It's really a decision I can't make. It's really people on the spot. I mean, I hesitate to advise people in Lithuania to cut the throats of the ruling elite. But I think there's also a third way, which they might at least entertain, namely not doing anything, just dumping them. I mean, not giving them shares, just let them sweat it out on the free market. Without shares in there from their rotten management, in the past. I think that's a compromise, a middle way, which I offer, peaceful middle way. Just let them find productive employment on the free market, like being boot blacks or whatever, domestics. I think, and also another point I think is important is the money question, which has been alluded to here. It has to be real market money, sound money, means commodity money. And the point of the gold standard, I think, was raised, a very important one. I think it's very interesting. Wayne Angel went over to Moscow and advised the Soviets to go to the gold standard. There's a fascinating article in Wall Street Journal on this thing, and they asked them, and they said, well, and the interesting, they gave back to him the usual Western arguments, the usual sort of Greenspan type arguments, if I can use that expression too. They'd say, well, yes, but Professor Dr. Angel, we're supposed to only go back to gold standard after long, many years and decades of balancing the budget and having problems, this, that, and the other thing. He said, yeah, well, it's true in the United States, but nobody trusts the ruble anymore, so therefore you have to have to get people to trust the ruble by going immediately to gold coin redemption. And then he said that was honest money. All this paper money and stuff is not honest. Then they asked him, of course, the nice, logical, naive, and logical question. They said, well, how come you have dishonest money in the United States? Why don't you have a gold standard? And they said, well, because we can get away with it. We have a history of gold in the past. They trust the dollar, but they don't trust they don't trust the ruble, which I think has interesting implications. What do we do next? Right? And we should have at least as good of money as Russia does, or will, might have in the future. So, and of course, when you talk about getting to the gold standard, well, first of all, there has to be convertible rubles and zlotys and all the rest of it. Obviously, it has to be convertible into Western money. And the exchange rate has got to be the market exchange rate. It seems to me absurd to have impose some kind of arbitrary exchange rate. You take the market, and whatever the market exchange rate is now, you go from there. You just proceed from there, whether it's 10 to 1 or whatever. And it's very unfortunate that Professor Hoppe was telling us about the East German mark, etc. They subsidize the East Germans outrageously at the expense of the West Germans is what they're doing. Go back at 10 to 1 or whatever the market mark rate is. And proceeding to the gold standard means, of course, redefining the tough part is defining the mark of the franc of the dollar in terms of the weight of gold. How do you do it? Well, I mean, there's no science about it. You start with the most convenient point, but as with any definition, a yard is defined as 3 feet or whatever.
You have to proceed from there.
So, stock of money is, you make it the most convenient, say, I would say 100% gold standard myself. And just go on from there. Then you have a redeemable a ruble or mark or zloty or dollar at that original weight. So it's not simple. On the other hand, it's not as difficult as one might portray if you really have the will to do it, especially in this plastic juncture of history. So all these things, of course, should be done together and once and fast. I mean, to eliminate all these. The interesting thing is, to me, it's fascinating because in Western politics and Western academic circles, if anything is considered good, any change, you have to phase it in. The more you phase it in, the better. 10 years, 20 years, the slower the advance to a good position, the better, supposedly. But here and now in Eastern Europe, things are so bad, it's admitted the faster the better. It's already a great position. Now, of course, we'll then apply to the United States. Why not the faster the better here, too? Why do we have to suffer the slowness of... I think that's the... One of the things I just want to say in closing on this thing is that I've been accused all my life of being an evil deflationist. And this is a very puzzling phenomenon here because I'm in favor of allowing the banks to collapse. I consider fractional reserve banking is inherently bankrupt. And every once in a while they're caught up, such as the SNL situation now. They're immediately bailed out. Hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money poured into it. So I'm a deflationist. I'm willing to allow a contraction of the money supply on behalf of smashing fractional reserve banking, which I believe originally deserves it. On the other hand, and I say this has been scorned, even among Austrians or free market types. Well, now we have an alleged hero is coming out of the blue, like Ferdinand Collor de Mello, as you pronounce it, in Brazil, an alleged free market person. And as soon as he comes in, he freezes 90% of the money supply. You can't get your money out of the banks. It seems to be monstrous. I mean, not just... The government prints all the money, spends it, and drives prices up, and then the government comes along as an alleged cure to this and freezes the money you earn in your bank account to allegedly cure the previous inflation. Excuse me, he's adding a one-two rabbit punch to the public, and yet he's being hailed by the establishment press as great. Well, I mean, they need a good solid sort of a shock treatment. The shock treatment I've always proposed has been much, I mean, seems like lovable compared to this, and yet this is considered deflationist. It's kind of a strange situation. Maybe somebody here can explain this peculiar reversal. And I'm convinced, by the way, that one of the reasons why the Mario Vargas Llosa is probably losing the election in Peru, and who's hailed by every libertarian press across the world as being a great libertarian, is one of the reasons he came out in favor of the Collor de Mello plan. The average Peruvian looking, hey, they're getting their all their assets confiscated. I would vote for this fellow, Narashima, whatever his name is, myself. I can understand why they would do it. He's promising, he's not a coherent economist, he's promising a lot of Japanese private investments. Great. So, anyway, these are some of the pitfalls. In conclusion, one of the interesting things about Longa, which always rubbed me the wrong way, so I thought I'd finish on this note. When he proclaimed his triumphant solution to the Mises problem in 1936, he delivered a famous sardonic jibe at Mises. He said, well, socialists should be grateful to Mises for raising this problem, which he long has now solved, and it's an important challenge. And therefore, he said, quote, a statue of Professor Mises ought to occupy an honorable place in the Great Hall of the Ministry of Socialization, or the Central Planning Board of a Socialist State. He added that the statue could be used to exemplify the Hegelian cunning of reason, which had made, quote, even the staunchest of bourgeois economists unwillingly serve the proletarian cause, unquote. Well, now we have an ironic twist of the Hegelian dialectic that Lange scarcely foresaw, because the socialist countries, first of all, socialist countries never, even including Poland, never raised a statue to Mises. Somehow they omitted this part of the program. And second of all, of course, they're moving rapidly in the Misesian direction. If they really agree that Mises is right, and they're trying to move as quickly as they can to private ownership, sound money, free trade, and free markets. And perhaps when this glorious process shall be completed, all these countries in Eastern Europe are free, and all the statues of Lenin have been torn down, which are in the process, of course, of being, perhaps they will be they'll raise the benign likeness and image of Ludwig von Mises in the public squares of Moscow, Warsaw, Prague, and Budapest. And not an ironic thanks this time, but a profound gratitude. But one thing I'm very certain, that we know statues raised Oscar Lange any place. Thank you. Sheldon?
You mentioned that no one had thought about how to be socialized. Yeah. I have an impulse to drop the name of Henry Hazlitt.
Yeah.
The only exception in his book.
Fantastic. It's a great book. It's called A Great Idea, and it was then reprinted as the, what was the name? Time Will Run Back. It was a novel. It was one of the few novels, I don't really read novels, but one of the few novels I like, which maybe says something about novel taste, but I thought it was great. And it's an exciting, intellectually exciting novel, and it starts with the dictator of a world communist government. And he's a new dictator. For some reason, he's the son of the previous dictator, and he's been raised on an island, doesn't know anything about social philosophy. He was a poet or something, right? And he becomes the dictator of this world communist. I recommend everybody read it. It's really extremely relevant today, much more than it was in 1951. And he realizes this situation isn't working well. Something's screwed up. He hasn't read any theory or anything, either Marx or Mises or anybody else. And he starts, well, let's improve the situation. He starts, why don't we allow people to exchange their ration tickets? So if somebody has a sugar ration, he doesn't like sugar, why can't he exchange it for somebody else's canned peaches if he doesn't like canned peaches? And of course, the Brezhnev types, the Stalinist types are against it. No, no, it's evil, it's capitalism, and now why not do it? It'll improve everybody's lot. They exchange ration tickets, it works very well. And it goes step by step. It's just great, because step by step, each chapter, he finds, discovers more and more of the market. And at one point, as a friend of mine said when he read it, he got an emotional thrill because at the end of the money chapter, he arrives at the concept of the real money is the gold ounce or the gold gram. He arrives at it purely by logical, by working practical and logical deduction. And he finally winds up with a purely free market. And also, in one chapter, he refutes the mathematical economist version of socialist calculation. He attacks that. Just a great book. I mean, it's really, everybody should read it, and it's super. Thanks for the correction. Yeah.
Two answers for your questions. You asked what to do, how to employ those people
right.
Who used to work
yeah.
Secret police.
Right.
One possible employment was mentioned when they can set up their own detective agency.
That's like, right, use their expertise.
The story in Poland is that they supposedly the best jobs for them are to be taxi drivers. You get the cab, you get in, and the guy asks you, are you going home?
He has the orders, right? You follow orders.
And the other thing is that Mr. Korwin-Mikke, in his campaign, was explaining why it was necessary for Poland to become capitalist immediately and for the United States may not be. He was saying, well, the United States is a rich country. They can afford to have 30% socialism. Mm-hmm. Poland is just too poor.
Yeah.
I think we just threw them that's right. Here to be kind of
yeah. Good point. David?
You said that the ninth cause of the capital.
I think so.
Underestimated the biggest problem. But I have trouble with Schumpeter, who really disliked socialism
yeah.
immensely.
Mm.
Because
he's Walrasian. He thought that the you have this instant imputation from consumer goods to capital goods. Well, I wouldn't say he believed in socialism. He just thought there was no economic problem because of that. It's very strange. It's one of the it's what comes from being a Walrasian. but it's interesting. Yeah, you know, because Hayek talks about that. Schumpeter's strange. Yeah, it's one of his. I think in Individual and Economic Order or something. He talks about Schumpeter's discussion and I think it was Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy on that. Both of these, Knight and Schumpeter, were very anti-socialist. Just they didn't see the economic problem that Mises was raising. Yeah, Alejandro.
Well, you told us that we could learn a lot from the practical side going on the Mm-hmm.
The socialist world.
Sure.
Yeah. But then you said something about the possibility of going to this step without pain.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering on the possibility of learning from the theoretical point of view as well. The Western world is pretty much socialist, and socialism has been increasing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory of the business cycle of the Austrians, shared by many here, I don't think that has started incorporate the philosophy of the state appropriately to its theory. So whenever we say in hyping theory, well, we're going to stop inflation, we're going to have a crisis, yes, or a recession. I have my big theoretical doubts that that's what will occur, although we have more a bigger private sector than in Eastern Europe. The amount of advantage from hyperinflation to a sound currency may more than counterbalance, the negative side.
Right. There always will, always would have to be a recession, but it can be counterbalanced by others, by great growth and enthusiasm, etc. It's interesting, in the German hyperinflation of 1923, the Bresciano Gironi talks about this, and they finally stop this monstrous inflation. One of the arguments against stopping is because there will be a recession afterward. Here the situation is much worse than any recession. It's a total catastrophe. And yet they're worried about a recession. So finally they stop it. And there is a recession, not a big recession, not a big deal, but there was a recession after 23 for a year or something. So, but as you say, I think it's overweighted by the fact you have a tremendous outpouring of enthusiasm and relative certainty about what the currency is going to do and so forth and so on. You have a tremendous increase in saving investment, which can make the liquidation recession seem very minor. I think that's what happens. Yeah, boy.
Perfect knowledge of the world, there could still be a calculation problem. I was wondering if you could flesh that out a little bit. If you think of the world as it was a static world and there was perfect knowledge,
I didn't say it was perfect. I wouldn't say perfect knowledge. The knowledge of the, assume that the planning board has knowledge of all the value scales of everybody and the techniques and resources. They still wouldn't know what to do next. I mean, what do you do with this? How do you have costs and pricing and all that sort of stuff throughout the whole structure of production? There's no way they can do it. That's the point. Even in a static system, even with the knowledge of the planning, omniscience of the planning board, they still wouldn't know that. They know the data, Walrasian data, right? The techniques, resources, a list of resources and everybody's value. They're still going, what to do next? Unless you're in a Crusoe situation or just a small peasant, family or something, you can do it, but you can't do it with a complex system. That's the main part of the calculation problem. It's been overlooked as Hayek misstated the terms of the argument. Professor Salerno has been doing a lot of great work on this. He has an article in Review of Austrian Economics, current, just came out on this, and also very good. He has a postscript to the Mises article, which is being reprinted, which goes in further into this. It's great stuff. It's one of the most creative work done on praxeology in a long time.
This needs to be calculated. So you aren't talking about a DRE when you're saying. You aren't talking about a DRE when you're saying. Because it needs to be self-saying DRE.
I'm not talking about it. Never land of ER of general equilibrium. No. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Bert.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.